My Mac Podcast number 127, sponsored by Audible.com. What do we got this week, Chad?
We've got Rose Yao, the Google Desktop for Mac Product Manager.
The next generation of radio, it's the MyMac.com Podcast.
And coming up later in the show, Chad and I did an interview with Rose Yao. She is the product manager for
Google Desktop for Mac.
Yep. So someone from Google is going to be right here on the show.
Yep.
I would almost say that's slumming it for them, I think.
Probably. But, hey, we appreciate them coming on anyways to Google, talk about new stuff.
Yeah, everybody knows Google is a company, but you know what? They're starting to crank out some Mac software, and we need to start giving them some attention on the show, I think. They're not paying us for it, but...
We sure do appreciate their efforts, though, as Mac users.
As Mac users, absolutely. If the biggest, one of the biggest companies now for, is it just internet? It's. I think they're. I don't know. I don't know how to classify Google. They're not just a search engine.
They're not.
They sell ads. That's where they're making their money.
But they're also creating some really cool software too.
Yeah, Google Earth is. And I say this during the interview. It's personally for me one of my biggest time wasters.
Yeah.
I love Google Earth. love it. But we're sans guy this week.
Indeed.
And so it's just Chad and I kind of, it's kind of weird, just you and me now, isn't it?
It's like the old days.
We can record the podcast, at least this aspect of it, this portion of it, without headphones on.
Yeah.
Kind of strange. So let's jump right into the news. And like I said at the beginning of the show, this podcast is sponsored by Audible.com.
AUDIBLE.com.
In the month of May, check out MyMac.com. The top banner will be from Audible. We'd appreciate it if you clicked it at least 25 times an hour.
That would be dandy.
So coming up from the news, no subscription service for iTunes.
And Steve Jobs said yesterday, because that would be Wednesday, he is unlikely to give in to calls from the music industry to add a subscription-based model to Apple's wildly popular iTunes online music store.
Never say never, but customers don't seem to be interested in it, Jobs told Reuters.
Yep.
In an interview after Apple reported blowout quarterly results. The subscription model has failed so far. His comments come as the company he co-founded gears up for a contract renewal negotiations with the major record label over the next month. So he's saying no.
We kind of touched on that last podcast
couple.
Before that.
Well,
yeah.
And last week as
too,
well.
Yeah.
I personally want to see a subscription model in iTunes. I think it's time. I think it would cause a lot more people to buy music.
And once again, I think if we see a Wi-Fi enabled iPod, you're going to see it.
I need something. Yeah. Apple released a new iPod game called the iQuiz. Did you look at this at all?
I have not even.
It only works with the Generation 5 iPod, the full-size iPods. They released it, I think it was just this week. It's only 99 cents, which is, I mean, it's 99 cents.
That is a good deal.
It's the price of a song.
Yep.
And the iQuiz includes four built-in games that will quiz you on your music, TV shows, and music, movies. Something like, what year was this?
Yeah.
You know, and it's pulling it from the metadata that's in the MP3 itself.
So it's kind of like the old music, or name that tune?
Yeah, it does very...
Except for it does more.
Yeah,
right.
Like who, what, when. You can actually, like, place bets in the game just to make sure, you know. It's kind of fun. I hear it's kind of fun. I haven't actually downloaded it. I'm a cheapskate. 99 cents sounds like a lot to me. The graphics are terrific, though. I saw some screenshots.
Really?
It looks really good.
Cool.
They had something like that on the iPod for a long time, that little, if you go under games, and it would play you a clip, and you had to guess. And it was fun. I like that. And so I'll probably download the iQuiz and give it a try. It's probably not a game you want to play while driving, though.
Yeah.
Speaking of driving, as Chad knows, I bought a new vehicle this last weekend, a minivan. Ugh.
The Family Guy.
Ugh. And I put a new stereo in it.
And already?
I know. I'm so bad.
You are pathetic. You just bought that over the other day for me to look at.
I know. And yesterday I put a stereo on it. I got a Sony that had this whole, it will control and play an iPod. All you have to do is buy this $50 add-on thing to it. So the store that I bought it from, and screw them, I'm not giving them any advertising. made me a deal. They'll sell me the cable, the iPod connection kit for $25 if I bought it right then. Mm. And I was going to buy it anyway, so I thought, oh, what the hell? So it's a Sony.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the Exploid, I don't know. Mm. It says something on there, but it's written in this font that it's kind of hard to read. Yeah. Now.
The Explode.
Something like that. And it will control the iPod through the deck. So I've got it all hooked up.
Mm-hmm.
It's the most convoluted, crappy interface.
Mm.
I can't get it to work right. I can't figure out how to go to different playlists. My daughters have their own music in my iTunes library.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, every time I plug the iPod into it, Britney Spears kicks out. I'm like, and I don't know why. It's not the first song in my playlist, on any playlist. It's not the first song in the library, but for whatever reason, Britney Spears plays on my iPod at the beginning whenever I plug it into the stereo system. Mm. So I'm really not that happy with it, but I just thought I'd share that. So Sony and your iPod connection kit.
There you go. Their love's kind of toxic.
Raspberry for you. Apple released their quarter two revenue.
Yep, $5.26 billion in revenue with net profit of 770 million schmackaroonies.
Mm, and they're still not advertising.
Yep.
Apple today announced financial results for its fiscal 2007 second quarter, which ended March 31st, 2007. The company posted revenue of $5.26 billion with a B, and net quarterly profits of $770 million. Or 0.87 cent per diluted share.
These results compare revenue of $4.36 billion and a net quarterly profit of $410 million, which was they saw a year ago.
Yep. Apple shipped 1,507,000 Macintosh computers,
10,549,000 iPods.
That's a 36% growth in Macs and a 24% growth in iPods. Which is kind of surprising. By just percentage growth alone, the Mac grew faster than the iPod in the last quarter.
Yeah.
That's kind of surprising to me.
And the Mac is clearly gaining market share with sales growing 36%, more than three times the industry growth rate, said Steve Jobs, Apple's CEO.
We're very excited about the upcoming launch of the iPhone in late June and also hard at work on some other amazing new products in our pipeline. Hmm. We're very pleased to report the most profitable March quarter in Apple's history, said Peter Oppenheimer, Apple CFO. You thought I was going to screw up that name, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
Looking ahead to the third fiscal quarter of 2007, we expect revenues of about $5.1 billion and earnings per diluted share of about 66 cents. Apple is a monster, man.
They are now.
They are just, they're huge. So, now these are kind of not in the order. I think I'm missing. Yep, I am.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't print everything that I was supposed to.
Get it.
Fred, I can't think of his name, the ex-CFO, Fred Anderson.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Basically, after he paid his fines in the whole backdating stock scandal, comes out and says Steve Jobs was behind it. Steve
really?
Jobs told me to do it. I even warned Steve Jobs about it, and Steve Jobs did it anyways. That this is all Steve Jobs. Yeah, here it is. Ex-CFO says Jobs warned of option dates. You see it right there?
Mm-hmm.
All right, go for it.
Two former Apple Inc. executives were charged with illegally backdating stock options by the Securities and Exchange Commission on Tuesday. The one is looking to shift some blame back on the company founder, Mr. Jobs.
The SEC on Tuesday filed charges against former Apple Chief Financial Officer Fred Anderson and former General Counsel Nancy Heinen.
Yep. These two are responsible for making sure that the board of the company were following along, and they abdicated those responsibilities, said Sahil Desai, the SEC staff attorney who led the investigation.
At the same time, the agency said it reached a settlement with Anderson, who did not admit or deny guilt and agreed to disgorge approximately $3.5 million, which represents what he personally gained from the alleged backdating.
I love that word, yeah. Disgorge.
Disgorge.
I'm going to puke up.
Hold on a minute while I get you through. Well, you know, if you're going to have to squeeze $3.5 million out of me, it's going to be disgorged as well.
Right.
In fact, you're going to have to clean it when I get rid of it.
Through his attorney, the 62-year-old Anderson said that he warned Jobs in late January of that year that the options grant in question would need to be priced based on the date of the actual agreement from the board of directors.
Jerome Roth, Anderson's attorney, said Jobs had assured Anderson that the board had given prior approval of the options grant. Anderson, through his attorney, said he now believes the Apple board may not have given the necessary prior approval to the grants issued in February 2001, contrary to what Anderson understood from Mr. Jobs and from the board, according to the statement. All of this comes from MarketWatch.com, by the way. I don't know. I don't think this is going to lead to any problems for Steve Jobs.
I don't think so. I don't think this is going anywhere to take
it. Excuse me. I've got a sinus problem.
So. I think the board's going to probably protect him.
Well, the last story we've got is Apple board members support Steve Jobs. Apple board members Bill Campbell, Millard Drexler, Albert Gore Jr. He had a strange job. Vice president of something.
Yeah, no kidding.
Arthur D. Levitson, Eric Schmidt, who's the CEO of Google, by the way.
And Jerry York today released the following statement. We are not going to enter into a public debate with Fred Anderson or his lawyer. Steve Jobs cooperated fully with Apple's independent investigation and with the government's investigation of stock option grants at Apple. The SEC investigated the matter thoroughly, and its complaint speaks for itself in terms of what it says, what it does not say, who it charges and who it does not charge.
Yeah, we have complete confidence in the conclusions of Apple's independent investigation and Steve's integrity and his ability to lead Apple. The statement is in response to ex-CFO Fred Anderson's comment that we just read.
Yep.
So the board's saying, you know what? The SEC's investigated. We've investigated. The only one saying that Jobs had anything to do with this is Fred Anderson. Now, what's the truth? I don't know. I'm just a podcast guy. What do I know? But I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting nonetheless. Robert Hazelrig's trying to buzz us in right now, but unfortunately we're not hooked up to talk to anybody on Skype.
No.
So, Chad, we've got a little bit more coming up on the podcast. My microphone's getting pushed out of the way by Chad's dog. Go on, scoot. The dog just wants some loving from me, Chad.
I got it.
Robert Hazelrig, who I just talked about, does a review of the Logitech Free Pulse wireless headphones, as well as an aluminum desktop stand from LaptopDesk.net.
And we've got another great Book Bites interview from John Nemirovsky.
Yeah, he interviews Tim Gray.
Yep, the author of Photoshop CS2 Workflow, The Digital Photographer's Guide.
But he's wishing it was Photoshop CS3 at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Probably not, though. Honestly, everything's probably just as relevant to CS3 as it is to CS2.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many people are going to be upgrading to CS3 really quickly. I think it's going to be a migration that's going to take at least a year before a lot of people are up at CS3 level. So, and from what I've heard, I can't say this from my personal point of view because I haven't used it yet, but I heard that CS3 really takes advantage of the Intel processor and not so much the PowerPC processor.
Right.
So that's something to keep in mind if you're on an all-Intel or an all-PowerPC shop. And you don't have the Intel, like Rick Stringer, like we were talking about last week, all their desktop machines are PowerPC.
Yep.
There's probably no need for him to upgrade to CS3. But I'm looking forward to getting my hands on a copy and reviewing it and seeing what it has to offer. And hopefully that will be in the next week or so. Let's jump up at mymac.com and see what's cooking. Remember, this podcast is sponsored by audible.com.
And we've got a Maxpiration number 82, Accidents Become Tips, from Danny Yankelo.
We've got two headphone reviews, one from Artie and one from John Nemo. One's for the ETY in-ear Bluetooth headphones.
And the other's for the SureSound isolating earphones, the Models SE210 and SE310.
You know, those Bluetooth headphones sound cool, but I don't know if I want all that extra crap just to listen to headphones.
Yeah.
You know? If it's wireless, it's wireless. The Bluetooth stuff right now just has too much stuff with it that you have to plug in. John also did the iKaraoke review. You remember how popular that was up at the podcast that we did up at the Apple Store for the Apple quiz? Everybody, we had two of those to give away from Griffin
Technology.
Everybody
wanted them.
That's what everybody wanted. Not the super expensive stuff. They wanted the iKaraoke. So I think that's a kind of a testament not only to that product, but to the popularity of the iPod itself. And lastly, Donnie Yankelo has a review of Coral Painter X.
Yep.
And after we review this podcast, if you remember that David Cohen on two podcasts ago, 125, did the whole dissertation about Adobe and what they're doing in cross-platform computing. It was excellent.
Yep.
And we do know that got the attention of Adobe as well, that they listened to it, and they were very grateful for his acknowledgement of their efforts in cross-platform computing, such as PDF.
Right.
I said that, you know, that was really good, and a lot of people listening to the podcast, everybody that's listening right now probably heard it, but not everybody that visits our website listens to the podcast. So he kind of wrote a condensed version of that as an article. I'm going to get that posted up before this weekend.
Oh,
so
great.
By the time anybody's listening to that, that should be posted up at mymac.com as well. And I got a new HP printer in today for review, so I'm going to be playing with that over the next couple weeks.
Yeah.
Anything up on your agenda? You got any reviews pending?
I do have a review pending. I have got this nice little leather case for my MacBook. I've got one drafted, and I just need to finalize that. And I've also got the Rhino case that I'd like to do, too, that Rhino skin Mac case.
Oh, yeah. I kind of like that one, too. Which one are you kind of leaning towards that you like better?
The Everyday. I like the leather one, although I feel like if you look at other leather products out in the market, it's probably a little pricey.
Yeah.
It does work well, though. For travel, I do like that Rhino skin. I have a few issues with a few little things.
It looks
things.
Kind of plasticky to me, though.
It is kind of plasticky, but it is durable. And one of the primary reasons that I do like it is when I do have to travel, particularly air travel, it's a nice case to have around. Plus, you can also use it as a backpack or shoulder strap is how I tend to use it. But
well, we need to wrap it up because I'm freezing my butt off. Chad's furnace went out today.
Yeah.
It's a little nippy.
A little
in
nippy
here.
In my house and will be till tomorrow.
The computers like running into a little bit of a cooler air, but I don't.
So we've got our hands huddled in front of the G5.
Keep me up a little bit. So let's go ahead and jump to the Google interview.
And this is Rose Yao from Google. And we're here with Rose Yao from the Google Mac development team. How you doing, Rose?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
So you work for Google. I heard this is some small company. It's a pretty new startup, right?
Yes. So Google...
How long have you been at Google?
I've been here for over a year now, and it's been a lot of fun for me to be a product manager at Google, especially on the Mac team.
Yeah, you're working for Google, one of the, from what I've heard, greatest companies to work for in the world today, and you're working on Mac software. How great
exactly.
is your job?
I do have everyone's dream job. It's true.
You don't even need to play the lotto, do you?
It's so definitely Google, a lot of fun.
So Google came out with Google Desktop for the Mac, and a lot of people are excited to see this. What's going on with this new program?
So Google Desktop for Mac launched on April 4th of this year, and we were really excited for it to launch because it's one of the first big launches on the Mac platform from Google, and I think it really takes into account our mission of making information universally accessible. So the whole point of Google Desktop for Mac is that you should be able to find the information you want whenever, wherever you are. So we tried to do this by creating a search that is fast, easy, and comprehensive. And there's about three key features that I think are really important for users to know about. One is the Google integration. The second one is the quick search box. And the third one is just how comprehensive the search is. So what types of information do we search?
So Google Search Internet is built right into the system then?
If
I do a search in Google Desktop, it's actually searching Google.com as well.
No, absolutely not. So we don't send your searches back to Google.com. What we did do is integrate the UI of Google Desktop into Google.com locally so that for users who are on Google.com, and let's say you're doing a search, right? You're trying to figure out what's going on with the iPhone. And you realize that, hey, there's actually a couple documents on my computer that relate to that. Or, well, there were a few web pages that I've looked at 2 months ago that I want to go back to. Google Desktop is one click away because it's one of the tabs of Google.com. So you can click on that tab and instantly you have desktop results right, you know, one click away from your web results.
Another way, it is looking at my browsing history then too.
So one of the things we do is we store your web history locally. So you can obviously turn this on or off, but by default, it is on. So users, as they're surfing the web, were caching local copies of those web pages with Google Desktop so that you can search for them later. And this is actually a feature I find really, really useful. We've gotten a lot of great user feedback about it.
My question is, mm-hmm. a lot of Mac, I'm seeing a lot of posts out there, a lot of Mac users are saying, well, we already have Spotlight. What do we need Google Desktop for? My response is, you can never have too many search tools, but what's the official Google position on this? Why Google Desktop at this time for the Mac?
You know, I think you had a pretty good answer there. We really designed Google Desktop to be a companion to Spotlight. So I think that for the Google user, right, we want them to not have to think about where their information is and try to figure out what is the right tool to search for it at that time. So when you're on Google.com, Desktop is right there. The quick search box offers you a way to get to search no matter where you are. And I don't know if you've, there were a few articles out there this week that talked about how Google Desktop is a great tool for the pack rats. And I'm personally a pack rat, so I think that's definitely true as well.
So am I. I have way too many hard drives hooked up to my Mac. And even with Sherlock, or I'm sorry, boy, I'm really aging really, myself. Yeah. Even with Spotlight. You know, a lot of times Spotlight will not find everything I'm looking for, or it'll give me too much information. So I'm always looking for something that can maybe narrow my search down or give me a broader view of what I'm looking for. And I think being able to look back on past websites, to me, that's a selling point for me. I really want to be able to. I can't tell you how many times I'm doing research on a program or whatever, and I visited 20 websites in a day, I'm never going to remember which website, and I'm not going to bookmark them all. But yeah. At least with Google Desktop, I can find it again.
You're right. I have that exact same problem, and it's been really useful for me. Another thing we do is also search your Gmail offline. So I don't know about you guys, but I have about 2 gigs of information in my Gmail account. So what's really frustrating is that when I'm at the airport or I'm on the bus and I'm commuting to work, I just can't get to that email I need at the moment I need it. And Google Desktop has solved that problem for me, which, you know, has been fantastic.
Now, it's not pulling down the actual attachments, though, correct?
So it is pulling down the attachments for your Gmail emails. For mails, for emails that are stored on your computer, so emails in your Mail.app or Entourage, we don't search those attachments until you save them on your computer.
Oh, cool. Yeah. The other program that I have to talk about is Google Earth. This is one of the biggest time wasters. This is a bigger time waster for me than almost video games. I play with Google Earth all the time.
It's beautiful, right? I love
it. It is beautiful. I just wish that they had high resolution satellite images of where I live. They do about 5 miles, and I know you guys, you have no control over that, but it's what a great application. Mm-hmm. It's changed so many other websites that you go to. You go to a realtor website and you click it, and there's a little button now that says satellite, and you load it, and it's Google Maps. There it is.
Yeah,
it's Google Earth. It's fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely love the program as well, especially when you're planning to go on vacation. You can check out, you know, where your hotel is and the scenery around it and all that stuff before you even, you know, get to wherever you're going.
I love the program. So you guys have any future Mac programs in the works, or is this it for now?
You know, when we made the original announcement,
oh, we lost her for a minute, but we'll get her back.
Yep.
Happens all the time with our buddy Skype.
Yeah, sometimes it's a little more difficult.
Oh, there you are. We lost you right there.
We lost you for a minute.
Am I back?
You're back.
So where did we...
Okay. I had said, what's...
Which part can we collapse?
I don't know, Chad.
You said, so what's coming, what's in the pipeline next?
Yeah, what's in the pipeline?
Okay.
And just like the episode of Lost, it cuts you off, and now we're left to just speculate.
It was a cliffhanger. Or it's like those commercials where the person says something that could be inappropriate, but the other person on the other end doesn't take it and is laughing, but he can't hear it because the phone was just cut out.
Yeah, you guys should cut it off right there so that I have to listen to the next podcast.
What's next? Silence.
We just lost Rose Yao there. We are not sure why.
So one of the things I was just saying is that when we launched Google Desktop a few weeks ago, one of the biggest questions people asked was, so, you know, why are there no gadgets on for Google Desktop on the Mac? Is this coming? What's going on? And, you know, I'm happy to say that that is definitely functionality we're looking into for the Mac side. Obviously, we want to integrate with Dashboard in meaningful and useful ways, and we want to make sure we add value to the user's computer. But I think there's a lot of exciting integration that can happen in that area.
There's also a lot of third-party companies that's written widgets and stuff that uses Google APIs, or at least checks the Google website, or I have a Gmail widget that tells me how many emails are sitting in my my Gmail account.
Yep.
So, I mean, a lot of people are doing it for you when you kind of look at it that way.
Yeah, so we actually do have an official dashboard widget that checks your Gmail, does your, I think, personalized search, and also there's a Blogger widget as well. And another product that helps users who use Gmail and Calendar is Google Notifier. I don't know if you've used that at all. But
yep, I have.
Yeah, so the little menu bar icons that I've heard a couple users say that it's really helped them use Gmail more because now they don't have to be in a browser all day.
Mm-hmm. I have noticed that the Google Docs and Spreadsheet, which we actually use as a staff at MyMac.com to keep track of who's reviewing what, has reviewed something, what's the contact name for that company, and it's a private thing. We don't share it with anybody.
Right.
But it doesn't work in Safari. Is more Safari support coming from Google, or is that really not your where you're at?
You know, that's a really good point, and we one of the things we really believe in is letting users choose what tools they use at Google. So even on campus, you'll see a lot of people with Macs as well as PCs. And we do get a lot of feedback saying that there should be better Safari support. So we're excited to look into that for the future.
You know, Google and Microsoft has had kind of a contentious relationship over the years. As Google has gotten bigger, Microsoft's got felt more threatened and all that. But somehow, even though Google is getting really, really big, Apple and Google seems to have a great relationship, and Mac users really seem to love Google as a company. Do you see that on the Google campus as well?
So do I see on the Google campus users
a lot of Mac
Macs?
Users, yeah.
Yeah, actually, I do see a lot of Mac users on the Google campus, and It's personally really great for me as the product manager for the Mac team because it means I get a lot of feedback internally about our products. So before we launched Google Desktop to the public, we actually launched it internally several months before, actually. And we got great feedback from users internally who said, wow, these are things we need to fix, these are things we really love, and we can't wait to see more. So the sentiment is very similar to, you know, Mac users outside Google.
Any plans for an update to Google SketchUp?
So the SketchUp team is, you know, obviously working on great and new features. I don't know what they are, but, you know, I'm sure that we'll all find out soon.
That's another application that's really, really powerful. And when you see a company or individuals implement it using that and Google Earth, it's just amazing some of the 3D rendering jobs that they can do.
Yeah, 3D Warehouse has some amazing models in it.
They had, I think it was Google SketchUp. I don't know if it was from Google or it was somebody else using Google SketchUp at the Macworld Expo, and they actually had a demonstration of how powerful and neat it is. I mean, you can literally zoom in with Google Earth and then rotate it so you can see what the building looked like. It was just amazing. It was fantastic. Well, Rose, I want to thank you for coming on to the show today, telling us a little bit about Google Desktop and the other Google products. One of the last questions I want to know is, what kind of Mac do you use? We always ask people that. What Mac are you using?
I use a MacBook Pro. I'm really excited about it. It's the latest model. It's core, you know, dual core and beautiful and shiny.
Do you wish that Apple would come out with a sub notebook as well? I really want a sub notebook. I want a 12-inch MacBook Pro with all the ports, but I want it small.
Yeah, you know, I actually would love that because I'm always excited about, you know, a lot of the things, gadgets I carry are small. I really like small things. So, you know, I have a Shuffle and all that. So, but I think it's a resolution problem. Like, I do need more than 1240 by 800 or something like that on my screen.
Yeah, so do I, but I still want it small. I want to be able to flip the screen sideways and use it that way.
Wow.
That would be kind of neat.
We should tell someone at Apple about that.
Yeah, they don't listen to me.
They won't even come on our podcast.
No. Although we have had the ex-CEO of Apple on,
that's
so that's
true.
Something. Well, Rose, thanks a lot for coming on. And if you guys are interested in learning more about the Google software for your Macintosh, check out google.com/Mac and have a good day, Rose.
All right. Thanks,
Rose.
Guys so much.
Thanks.
Bye.
Hello, Robert Hazelrig here. Today I'd like to talk to you about the Logitech FreePulse wireless Bluetooth headphones. But first, I want to talk to you about the aluminum desktop stand for notebook computers by Lapworks. So, what can you say about the aluminum desktop stand for notebook computers that's not in its own name? Because it's an aluminum desktop stand for notebook computers. Well, for one, they could have added swivel into the name. I'm sorry, enough silliness. What I can tell you about the stand is extremely durable and extremely light. It has 6 adjustment heights, and yes, just as I mentioned, it does swivel a full 360 degrees. It comes with 4 rubber feet that you can stick on the bottom of your laptop just in case your laptop slides around a little bit. And it also has a front edge that holds your laptop in place, which also has some rubber type rings on it to help hold your laptop in place. It comes in its own black cloth case, and when folded inside the case, it is extremely thin. What I mean by extremely is it's about 1/4 inch thick, so it's ideal for travel. The Lapworks aluminum desk stand for notebook computers will retail for $70 after May 31st. So if you're interested in this, you might want to move over to lapdesk.net right away because they have an introductory price of $59.99. Next up, the FreePulse wireless Bluetooth headphones from Logitech. The FreePulse headphones use Bluetooth 2.0 EDR. Is this a good thing? I don't know. But they did sound really good. They weigh approximately 2 ounces and have a range of about 33 feet. I found them to be very comfortable. However, in my real-world usage, in my office space, when I plugged these into my G5 tower and walked around the office, I didn't quite get to about 30 feet. I think that had a lot to do with office equipment and filing cabinets that obstructed its range. However, use with a G5 tower is not its primary use. Its primary use is to be used with a portable MP3 type device, such as an iPod. In fact, it comes with 6 adapters for nearly every iPod available today. This makes these wireless headphones ideal for joggers, runners, or people who are working at the gym and don't like the cords that normally would get in the way. The FreePulse wireless headphones from Logitech retail for $99. However, I've seen them as inexpensive as $80 on Amazon.com. So, just to recap, today I talked to you about the FreePulse wireless headphones from Logitech, as well as the aluminum desktop stand for notebook computers by Lapworks. That's it for me this week. This has been Robert Hazelrig. Thank you for listening.
There's an author whose last name is Gray, but all of his books happen to be in red. I guess that means that he's very well read. The author is Tim Gray. The 3 titles are Photoshop CS2 Workflow, Color Confidence, and the book we're going to be discussing specifically today on Book Bites Live in the MyMac.com podcast, Adobe Photoshop Lightroom Workflow by Tim Gray. The publisher is Cybex. The cost in the United States is $40. It's $48 in Canada, and it's £27 in the UK. We have Tim Gray live with us on the line. Nice to meet you, Tim.
Good to be here. Thanks very much, Sean.
Glad that you are writing these terrific workflow books. How do you divide your time and energy among your many articles, books, and workshops and personal appearances all over the world?
Well, you know, it's a question I get a lot because people have the impression that I'm doing a tremendous amount of work. And I guess with as many books and articles as I've written and as much traveling as I do, it definitely calls for a lot of time. And I think the key thing is just staying focused and working on the highest priority item first. I've always got a lot of projects going on, and so I have to focus on making sure I spend the time that each requires and that I do the one that's got the closest deadline first. But as my publisher can attest, that doesn't always mean I make my deadlines.
Okay, well, we accept that. You're allowed to be human. You have the title Workflow in two of your books, Photoshop CS2 Workflow and Lightroom Workflow. Briefly, what is Workflow and why is it so important, either in Lightroom or in Adobe Photoshop?
Well, in my mind, workflow is just a process for how you're going to approach a particular task. And the reason that I feel it's so important is I think that photographers, in this case, will get a better value out of the work that they're doing, out of the process that they're applying to their photographic images, if they understand the overall concept so that they can be a little bit more flexible in how they're approaching the image. And so I try to avoid a situation where I'm giving you a recipe of, you know, step-by-step exactly what to do to produce the effect you're looking for. And instead, I'm trying to make sure that the reader is understanding the concepts that are involved so they know how to approach their image, how to think about their image, and what process to go through to make the image look its best.
Well, I certainly appreciate that because in real life, this is also what I do, teach digital photography and Photoshop, mostly to beginners and intermediates. And we're very, very conscious of the step-by-step workflow. And so we're delighted that you're able to take us under the hood a little bit, especially with Lightroom, which is a new application.
Yes.
And one of our podcasters, David Cohen, has recently done an extensive comment also on Lightroom in his Fenestration episode of a couple of weeks ago. But he didn't really mention aperture, which comes from our friends at Apple Computer. Is aperture the same thing as Lightroom, just with a different name? What are the various strengths and weaknesses of aperture versus Lightroom, author Tim Gray?
Well, I think that both of them are very similar. Certainly, they're not, you know, aperture is not Lightroom in a different package. There are certainly differences between the two, various strengths and weaknesses. Certainly, Lightroom gets a lot more attention because Adobe has a well-earned reputation for being expert in the field of digital imaging and digital photography, and certainly they've got lots of experience there with Photoshop and the various other applications they've created, and they've applied that expertise to Lightroom. So there's certainly a good reason why I think they get a little bit more attention. I think another important consideration there is that Lightroom is cross-platform. You can use it on both the Windows and Macintosh machine, whereas the Apple Aperture application is only available for the Mac, of course, since it's an Apple product. So I think that, you know, that those are key things that, you know, for this audience, you know, while photographers are generally perceived as being Macintosh users in the professional photography space, it's about an even split, about 50-50 between Windows and Macintosh users. And among the broader advanced amateur and hobbyist audience, it's even more swayed toward Windows. So I think that's part of the reason is there's just a lot more Windows users that are looking for an application like this.
Well, we in the photographic community consider Lightroom and Aperture to be excellent applications for cataloging and managing and storing and keeping track and working with your images in small, especially in gigantic quantity. But when we open up your book, Adobe Photoshop Lightroom Workflow by Tim Gray, published by Cybex, we want to know how long does it take to become familiar with Lightroom starting from scratch since it's such a new application?
Yeah, it is a brand new application. Of course, it's been out there in a public beta form for a while, but it is a brand new application. And you know, the answer is really that it varies. It depends upon the particular person. I think for photographers who have been working in Photoshop for a while, and especially if they're familiar with Bridge, the file browser that's included with Photoshop, I think within a day or two, they can get very comfortable using Aperture because they're already going to be familiar with the basic concepts that are involved. But even for those who are not necessarily familiar with other Adobe products or other imaging applications, I think it's laid out in such a manner that it's fairly straightforward and relatively user-friendly. Now, to be sure, there's some complicated aspects to it, but I think it's designed in a manner that makes it easy to go from task to task, and that, you know, once you know how to use one module, you sort of know how to use all five of the modules that you'll find within Lightroom, because each of them use the same basic concepts for the controls that are there. So I think, you know, for someone who's more experienced with especially Photoshop and Adobe Bridge, I think a day or two just to get familiar and understand the differences there. And for those that are completely new to this type of software, you know, I think within a week or two, they'll start to feel very proficient with the application.
Well, would you say that people need to understand your entire Lightroom book to be proficient using this software?
I don't think they need to understand the entire book, but part of that depends on how they're working and what they plan to make use of within Lightroom. As I mentioned, there's five modules, the library module, the develop module, and then you've got print, slideshow, and web. Those three, of course, the last three are designed strictly for sharing your images. And so if you're not going to produce prints from within Lightroom, or if you don't want to post your images onto a website, or you don't use it to create slideshows, well, then there's big sections that you're not necessarily going to need to master before you can make good use of Lightroom. And, you know, in my book is broken up so that each of those modules has its own chapter, making it a little bit easier to break those into the individual components you need most. But I think the photographer who is going to make the most use to get the greatest advantage out of Lightroom is going to be using most, if not all, of the individual modules. And so from that perspective, I think it makes sense to go through, you know, a book such as mine or any of the other materials that are out there, start to finish, to try and get a handle on the entire package before you get too far involved in it.
Thank you. And let's remind our listeners, you are listening to Book Bites Live here on the MyMac.com podcast. Our author is Tim Gray, G-R-E-Y, and the book under discussion is Lightroom Workflow, published by Cybex. Unlike many other photography authors, most of the images in this book, Lightroom Workflow, are from a well-known, well, not well-known to me, but well-known to you, photographer named Andre Costantini. Is that correct?
Andre Costantini, yes.
And his website is sillydancing.com. Briefly tell us why you chose Andre's pictures as opposed to Tim Gray's or anybody else's.
Well, there's two reasons. The first is, why did I not use my own images? And while I love photography, I don't pretend to be any great photographer. And I've written quite a number of books. I think the count now is at about 12 books that I've authored or co-authored. And so, frankly, I've started running out of pictures that I think are even remotely worthy of putting into a book. And so I'm always on the lookout for other photographers. I've used a number of images from professional, well-known professional photographers in my books. But one of the things I've enjoyed very much as I travel around to different events to speak, you know, about Photoshop and Lightroom and other topics related to digital imaging is the opportunity to meet up-and-coming photographers and some of the lesser-known photographers or photographers that are just starting to get a name for themselves that have incredible images. And Andre was one of those that I've met at some of the different industry shows and got to know him a little bit. You know, we both would speak at these events, and I was impressed with his images. And as I started working on Lightroom Workflow, realized that in this case, it really made sense to have a cohesive set of images. And so I asked if he'd contribute some images so that I could base the book around a cohesive set of images that would follow a typical workflow. And he was kind enough to let me use some of his great images, which I'm very grateful for because they look a heck of a lot better than anything I would have done.
And we will put that link to his website, sillydancing.com, on our show notes, along with all the references to this book by Tim Gray. Well, while we're talking about websites, just tell us briefly what we'll find on your website, timgray.com.
Well, in part, you'll find a website that's overdue for a makeover, but beyond that, you'll find basic information about my books, of course, a listing of the many magazine articles that I've written over the years, and information about an email list that I put out where I answer questions related to digital imaging.
Okay, and that's all right there at timgray.com.
Yeah.
Very good. How easy and intuitive is it to create slideshows and web galleries using Lightroom? You get to that by about the last 20, 30 pages of the book.
Yeah, I think it's actually quite easy in Lightroom. Now, you know, some photographers probably find that they're a little frustrated. They don't have as much control over the process. You're not able to create your own customized templates to make the page, for example, in the case of a web gallery, look exactly the way you'd like it to. But within the limitations that it has, it gives you a pretty good amount of flexibility. And in my mind, the most important thing is that it's incredibly easy to create these web galleries. So using the web galleries as an example, so for, let's say, a photographer who primarily photographs weddings, they want to get those images sorted and posted to a website quickly and easily so that they can share them with a client. And with Lightroom, you can, the process, once you've decided on a template that works for you, or if you've created your own custom template that works for your needs, making a gallery on your website is as simple as selecting the images you want to include in the gallery, selecting the template that you want to use, and then publishing the images. You just click one button. And because you've entered in your information about your server where your website is located, and because you've got this template, it's that easy. So you go through once and configure things the way you want it, and from that point forward, it's incredibly easy to publish a web gallery. So that's, I think, the biggest advantage of Lightroom, is that you put a little bit of effort into defining things the way you want them, and then your workflow just flies by very, very quickly after that.
Because I was starting to get nervous that I was back to VisiCalc or learning Lotus 1-2-3 when you started talking about grids and cells, like 167, 170, 172. And I was going to ask you, author Tim Gray, is this photo software or a spreadsheet? But I think we'll let that one pass, and the readers can decide that for themselves.
Well, I think we have to remember, too, that oftentimes some of these things get named by the engineers that are working on it, so they're thinking a little more technically than we might otherwise.
One of the big things that we've learned from your colleague, Deke McClelland, is that the new version of Photoshop CS3 handles creating grayscale images from color RAW or color JPEGs much more proficiently and with much greater tonal range than in the past. Would you say that Lightroom creates superior grayscale images compared to Adobe's new Photoshop CS3?
I would actually say that they produce equivalent results. They both provide, via different methods, an ability to convert an image from color to grayscale, where you can adjust the relative brightness of each individual color within the image. And these are provided via a black and white adjustment layer, or a black and white adjustment within Photoshop CS3, whereas in Lightroom it's just part of the grayscale adjustments. But the basic controls are the same, where you can adjust the relative brightness of each individual color within the image, which for those familiar with the old process of using Channel Mixer to blend the individual channels, it's both much easier and much more flexible because it's giving you all of the individual colors, not just the three primaries.
So you don't need to worry if your values are 300 or 400 like we used to have to worry about.
Exactly. You don't even have to think about that. You just look at the image and think about, you know, which areas do you want brighter versus darker. For example, you want the sky darker. Naturally, you're going to look toward the blues and the cyans. You can just think about the individual colors that comprise the image and then adjust the sliders to brighten or darken those areas individually. And you don't have to do a whole lot of thinking. You just look at the image and work from an aesthetic perspective.
At the very end of Lightroom Workflow by Tim Gray, there is a one-page workflow overview. And am I being unfair by saying this seems a little bit skimpy? By the way, the total page count in this book is 207 Lightroom Workflow. So am I being unfair of saying it's a little bit thin when, after giving us all this stuff about workflow, you reduce it to one brief page?
I guess the summary is skimpy, but that's by design. The basic idea there is that I wanted to give photographers a way to sort of summarize the process they should be going through with their images, recognizing, of course, that there's no one right answer there, that you can go through it in a variety of different ways. But to give a summary of the approach that's taken in the book step by step, not by way of telling you how to do it, but reminding you what those steps are. And I think, you know, the book is not terribly long. It's a you know, moderately length book, but it gives you all the detail you need to be able to work in Lightroom efficiently. And I think that, you know, it's not a huge book, and so it's relatively easy to read it cover to cover, I think, I hope.
Yes, it is easy to read.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. Glad I was successful, at least for you, and hopefully the other readers will agree. But the appendix there was just intended to give you a brief summary. So as if you kind of lose your place or you're forgetting how to approach your images in Lightroom, that you can just look at that one page reference and get a good sense of it, and then also know which chapter to go look at if you need to review in a little bit more detail.
MyMac.com Book Bites has received 3 books on Lightroom, and I'm sure there will be many coming out. But the one we've been discussing today is Adobe Photoshop Lightroom Workflow, author Tim Gray, also the author of Color Confidence and Photoshop CS2 Workflow, all published by Cybex, S-Y-B-E-X. We've been very glad to meet you on the Book Bites Live podcast segment at mymac.com podcast. Thank you, Tim, and we'll definitely be keeping our eye on your workflow.
Thanks very much, John. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.